To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Hello and welcome to That Horror Show Podcast with that dynamic duo of horror, Timothy Kazza and Christopher Koenig. When you think of horror, think of us. We are a podcast like no other, so sit back, relax, and enjoy That Horror Show Podcast, if you dare.
Hello, you lucky ducks, and welcome to another exciting episode of That Horror Show Podcast, episode number 3, entitled That Stalker Episode, Pop Stars and Novelists Watch Out, They're Your Number One Fans. I am your host, Tim Kazda, and with me tonight, the oats to my Hall, the pepper to my salt, and the Garfunkel to my Simon, the Professor Christopher Koenig. How are you, Chris?
Oh, I'm fine. How about you, man?
Oh, good, good, good. Anything new and exciting?
No, absolutely not. I wish I had something new and exciting to give. I wish I had, a day where my life was filled with explosions and lasers and, you know, dinosaurs and, you know, the world coming to an end. And it's like this fun post-apocalyptic story. But no, it's just a regular day for me. So it's, I mean, it is, I will say, though, you know, it's kind of a glum day. But the last week was very nice. So it's obviously the beginning of spring, and I'm ready for summer. Tell you the guys honest truth. I'm
yeah, me too. Me too. Well, I mean, I guess basically the biggest thing I've done this week, or the past week, is I just binge watched the new Netflix original series Daredevil. Have you heard about that?
No, I've heard about it. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh my God! Believe the hype. I mean, it's been on social media and it's been all over the place for like the past 3 months before it came out, and it does live up to the hype. And it's an extremely well crafted show.
I gotta check it out. I mean, I will admit I'm usually far behind when it comes to new TV shows. I mean, like, I've been catching up with Walking Dead and Boardwalk Empire and everything like that. I remember watching like the entire Breaking Bad series after when the show was over.
Yeah, I think our buddy Dave also did the same thing.
Yeah. But I think I'm trying to remember if it was still kind of on when he was, maybe it wasn't. But.
Yeah, it was. He was about 3 months after.
Yeah. But so it took me a while too. But yeah, I should check that out.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. Vincent D'Onofrio is awesome as a Wilson Fisk. He eventually turns into Kingpin, which is the bad guy that Matt Murdock. I'm sorry, Charlie Cox is the person that plays Matt Murdock, but who turns into Daredevil. But it's really a great show. Also, if you haven't been living under a rock, you may have not seen the second teaser trailer for Star Wars Episode 7. The Force Awakens, that was released on April 16th.
And well, I live under a rock, and I did see it. So.
Well, maybe you have Wi-Fi.
I was surprised we had Wi-Fi under that rock. They told me I didn't have any. But
Now, personally, me being a huge Star Wars fan, I can't wait for what J.J. has in store for us as Star Wars fans. But other than the two teaser trailers and some very light reading on a new film, I purposely kept myself in the dark on the whole thing because I wanted to be completely surprised and blown away by everything. So that's really what I've been up to.
Yeah,
I've probably seen that trailer about 400 or 500 times.
Yeah, I watched a trailer recently. As a matter of fact, you texted me yesterday. Say, check it
yes,
out.
Yes, I did.
So I did check
just
it out.
Just so we could talk about it a little
bit.
Yeah,
I know. No, that's fine. I figured we should just mention that little side story. Just, you know, it gives the subject a little more, you know, interest.
Oomph.
So, yes, a little more oomph. Maybe a punch in the face, too. I'll be honest that I'm ready. When I say this, I'm sure I may get.
Send your hate mail to Chris.
Hate mail to Chris, yes. I'm not a big Star Wars fan, so I mean, I can't really speak about any enthusiasm for the trailer personally or for the movie. The trailer does, however, look very promising.
Yes,
so
it does.
If you are a Star Wars, and I'm sure there's many of them out there, so I'm not. I'm sure that this trailer will pique your interests and it will catch your fancy, and I think that you'll. I think I might see you people standing out line in the theater to go see it.
You'll probably catch myself and Mark out there waiting for the midnight showing.
I'll probably be walking past and saying, I got to go do something else. But
I got to go to work.
But, it does look like a very, like the trailer has a lot of promise in it. So, again, Star Wars fans, you should keep a watch for this.
There's so many iconic scenes that they're showing from just to give you a little flavor. We're going to actually play that Star Wars trailer for you right now on our show. So, without further ado, if you haven't seen it, well, you can listen to it. All right, let's roll that trailer.
All right.
Force is strong in my family. My father has it. I have it. My sister has it. You have that power too.
Yeah, I personally love the ending touch with Chewbacca and Harrison Ford saying, "We're home." that just sealed the deal for me.
God, Harrison Ford, man, he's been going on strong for, jeez, how many, especially yeah. after that, you know,
the accident, of the Millennium Falcon door falling down on him. And then the other accident where he was flying a plane and he crashed into a golf course.
Right, right. It's but man, you know, still going strong. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I'm personally can't wait for it. So, anyway, without further ado, we're going to be moving into our segment of what we watched. So, let's turn on the boob tube.
You're still determined to push ahead?
Of course. This time we take the engine.
Passengers, as in the beginning, I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. Keep your place.
Security expert, he's in the prison section now. If we can get him to cooperate, he can take us all the way to the front of the train.
Keep going!
Are you Namgoon Minsu? Security specialist?
Cheaper just to let me rob the damn thing.
Hands up.
22 robberies, over $400,000 in losses.
Y'all notice he didn't mention any of the lives I've taken.
We will have Ben Wade convicted and hanged, and we will pay to make it happen.
I'll come.
So, boys, where are we headed?
Taking it to 310 to Yuma day after tomorrow.
Shouldn't have told him that.
Relax, friend. Now if we get separated, I know where to meet up.
You're so sure that your crew's coming to get you?
Sure as God's vengeance, they're coming.
Come this way, I've seen him.
There's gotta be 30, 40 more guns out there now.
Boss, you in there?
If you take him to the train, Pa, I'm going with you.
They're gonna kill you and your father, William. And they'll laugh while they do it.
Call them off.
Why should I?
Because you're not all bad.
Yes, I am.
This town's gonna burn!
You just remember, as your old man walked Ben Wade to that station when nobody else would.
All Well, I'll be discussing my recent viewing of the science fiction action hybrid Snowpiercer, made in 2013 by South Korean director Bong Joon-ho and written by...
God bless you.
Yes. And written by Kelly Masterson and Bong Joon-ho. So, Snowpiercer takes place in the distant and very harrowing future of 2031. The Earth has been affected by a global climate change experiment that went haywire, thus turning the entire planet into a snowy apocalypse with sub-zero temperature, which mankind cannot survive in. However, those who have survived inhabit an all-powerful train dubbed the Snowpiercer, designed by a man named Wilford, played by Ed Harris. The Snowpiercer is an intricate train system that can circle the entire globe, and the train is made habitable to live in for many years. Now, this sounds all well and good, doesn't it? Well, no, it isn't. The train is run through the old-fashioned class system, in which the wealthy high society types are stationed in the front of the train, while the poor dregs of society are left in the hovels of the back end of the train. So despite Wilford running his train with a tight fist, the lower-class passengers led by Curtis, played by Chris Evans, and an old-timer named Gilliam, played by John Hurt, revolt and attempt to make their way to the main engine through a series of brute force and over-the-top bloody scenarios. Now, before I saw Snowpiercer, I was told by someone who had viewed the film that it was all about global warming, and they had dismissed the whole show altogether. So naturally, I decided to rent the film from my local Family Video and give it a spin. And while the film isn't specifically all about global warming, it's really all about global cooling, since the Earth is all frozen and whatnot. That nitpicky detail aside, as a science fiction action combo, the results of Snowpiercer are indeed a mixed bag of decent visuals, but a drab script and a bloated running time. Bong Joon-ho handles the action and violent scenes with gusto, yet he also steps in it when utilizing cliched techniques like, you know, shaking the camera up and down side to side as the cinematographer had a nervous tic or relying on super slow-mo to drag the suspense when a brawl breaks out. The storyline has a few interesting concepts here and there, yet on the other side of the coin, Snowpiercer has so much action crammed into the story that you feel the ideas are somewhat underdeveloped and that Bong Joon-ho is covering up the script with the script flaws with flashy visuals. Add to that, despite being 126 minutes, Snowpiercer plays like it's just much longer than that. And once you get to the big finale, it just drags and drags and drags, all the while you're exclaiming, well, just get on with it already. But with that said, the acting is pretty decent, with Chris Evans making an interesting lead, suffering from a bout or two of conflict of interests and being the hero. And it's nice to see such old pros like John Hurt and Ed Harris giving it their all, despite their age. So, you know, bravo to them. So while not teetering on the verge of being good or bad, Snowpiercer is stuck somewhere in the middle as being a decent production that delivers some of the goods and at the same time dropping the ball on a few other items as well. But either way, it's an okay movie that I would say is not a complete time waster, yet I would still advise waiting to check out Snowpiercer when the rental fee goes down a buck or two, you know?
Okay.
And that's all I got.
Well, I'll save some questions I have for you after get into my review.
Oh, yes.
Now, leading that to moi, 310 to Yuma is what I watched from 2007, directed by James Mangold, starring Russell Crowe and Christian Bale, two personal favorite actors of mine. Ben Foster, who's quickly making his way up to being another favorite actor of mine, and obviously the legendary Peter Fonda. Now, this film was a remake of the same movie from 1957, starring Glenn Ford as Ben Wade and Van Helfland as Dan. I have not personally seen the original as of yet.
But, I have, though.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
But it is on my list. But
what's going on inside Christopher Koenig's head right now? But anywho, a broke rancher who is also a Civil War injured veteran, Dan Evans, played by Christian Bale, is on his way into town of Bisbee to see the man that sold him his land and to clear up a payment dispute, because the night before, his cronies had set fire to Dan's barn and made threats, telling him to leave because he was behind on his payments. Now, on his way into town, Dan runs into a stagecoach robbery in progress led by the legendary outlaw Ben Wade, played by Russell Crowe and his gang. They were robbing an armored stagecoach that was transporting a large sum of money for the railroad. This stagecoach was armed with Pinkerton security guards, led by Byron McElroy, played by the legendary character actor Peter Fonda. He was shot but not killed by Charlie Prince, Ben's right-hand man, played by Ben Foster. All these men gather in Bisbee. Dan goes to see the man that owes him money and is told he is shit out of luck. The man purposely stopped the flow of water to his farm so he could kick Dan off his property for not making the payments when he couldn't produce crops to make money. And then he was going to turn around and sell the land to the railroad company. Charlie goes to the sheriff and tells him about the robbery that had happened, and this clears out all the lawmen out of Bisbee. With them out of the way, Ben and the rest of his gang ride into town and hold up in a saloon. Now Dan has a chance meeting with a railroad liaison and is offered $200 to help transport Ben from Bisbee to a prison train, which just happens to leave in a couple of days on a 3:10 p.m. train to Yuma. Now the events that follow are truly awesome. Lots of great action and old-school six-shooter gunplay. Great cinematography that reminded me of films like A Fistful of Dollars, The Good, The Bad, The Ugly, Tombstone, True Grit, and Unforgiven. Both leads, Christian Bale as Dan and Russell Crowe as Ben, give 110% in my opinion. The script and pace are very good. There are definitely no lulls in the action or story, and I was never bored or looking at my watch. It should also be noted that Charlie Prince, played by Ben Foster, was wonderful. He excels at these psychotic, weird roles that you physically hate him, but I don't want to give away too much of the story because I think it would spoil it, so I won't. I highly recommend this to anyone, even if Western films aren't your thing. 4 stars.
That's my review.
Yeah, you know, you said Peter Fonda was in that. Is he driving a motorcycle and saying "man" a couple times with Dennis Hopper? And
no,
everything?
but he is the lead Pinkerton security guard. Okay. Right. And there is, and now having worked in security, and there was a quote by the railroad liaison. He goes, "They hired Pinkerton because they're the best men for the job, and they're paying him $18 a day, which is just roughly about what they make now." I kid too.
I have seen the 3:10 p.m. the remake of it as well. I remember liking it too. I actually like that in the original 50s film too. I think it's the perfect example where the original film works and the new film works as well, and they make great, interesting compare and contrasting.
Now, since you've seen that, now can you tell the listeners, is it basically the same story?
It's the same story.
Is there any kind of deviations, or is it just kind of like?
I'd have to go back and watch both to see again. But I remember the original one being, you know, it's more, it's a little more slowly paced. But I remember not sitting there looking at my watch or anything like that. I remember it being good as well. So I mean, both versions are worth checking out, but the remake's pretty good too. So I mean. And it's great seeing Russell Crowe playing a bad guy, you know.
He played the bad guy so, I mean, I don't know, when was the last time you saw it? Do you remember, like, how long
probably
ago?
Probably 2 years ago.
Okay. No, since I saw it about 2 weeks ago, my memory's a little more fresh. But he played, you know, Ben Wade was a character that, even though he was a bad guy, he still, like, could recognize good, and he still.
Oh, yeah.
And he still wanted Dan's characters to succeed and bring him to the train.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't want to see any ill will happen to him. He just, I don't know. It was like caught in the middle.
Yeah,
you know?
It is, because he's a bad guy, but like you said, he can see the good in the other character's personality. And once, in a certain way, wants the other guy to succeed. And it's very strange, because you'd think he'd want him not to succeed.
Right. And I think because, just for the fact that I think there's a line in there where he's like, well, I've escaped that prison like 4 times now. So
I'll escape it again.
it's no big thing that, you know, sure, I'll go, you collect your money, you take me to the train.
Yeah.
But now now Charlie Prince, who is the bad guy, like the enforcer, I want to say, now he is just playing by his own set of rules, and he's trying to get his boss back, but by any means necessary, and he'd kill anybody and everyone in this path, which is, I guess, kind of good to have on your side if you needed that. But he just couldn't be stopped, and it's a really good film. So I'd check it out if I were you. Anyway, now with that, now we're gonna get, I guess, into our meat and potatoes.
Well, wait a minute, you didn't ask me any questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding me. I'm so sorry, because I had like 3 things I wanted to say. Oh man, I am so sorry. Hold on.
It's okay. As long as I reminded you.
Yeah. No.
I mean, if you have questions, fine. If you don't, that's okay.
No, too. I do because truthfully, I've seen Chris Evans before, you know, in different movies like you know, Captain America, and I know he's done a couple other roles, but I was watching some clips and then the trailers for Snowpiercer when you told me about it, and there's a scene where he's like sitting in a train car and he's smoking a cigarette, and he's talking, he's like, and it was really disturbing because he goes, I've eaten humans before, and I hate to say it, but babies taste the best. I'm like,
oh yeah,
that
yeah,
really
yeah,
kind of
yeah,
freaked me
yeah.
out. I was like, why is Captain America eating babies?
Yeah. Well, it's this because you know it's this post-apocalyptic film, and you know, and again, like I said, the point of the Snowpiercer train is that the front end of the car has all these high, you know, they get the best living. You know, they're right. they're the high social status, and then you've got Chris Evans and his group in the back end, and they're talking about what they have to go through, and he mentions about, you know, eating babies and stuff like that.
Which is, how big is this train?
It's huge. It's like, well, like, again, this is a science fiction
right.
action film, okay?
Right.
So you kind of have to give it, you know, like, the benefit of the doubt. I mean, obviously, I mean, like, suspension of disbelief,
right.
I guess is the term. But it's a long train. I mean, right. the train has been designed to go literally like on these tracks that have been built around the world.
Okay.
So I think it was like they said it takes a year for the train to go around the world.
Okay.
So, but of course, this train is made habitable. Like, I think there's a scene where they, when they finally get to like the closer to the better part of the train, they're like in this bizarre aquarium inside it where
yeah.
like they see the fish and everything, and that's how they're able to raise the food and do all this stuff. I mean, and it's a neat concept.
Right.
I thought it was a neat concept, but it was just,
because I was watching clips, like I was just because I was interested because I've seen the trailer before and
yeah.
I'm like, well, I want to know a little bit more about it, and I don't really have time to watch the entire movie, but yeah, there was like a clip of where there's like sitting in this train car, they're eating sushi, and they're like the poor people are sitting next to like this rich person or whatever, or the more elite, and
yeah.
she's telling that they can only have sushi once a year because
yes,
they have to raise it, and I'm like. And then there's another thing where it was very strange. Like they're in a classroom and a
yeah.
music classroom, and then they're playing music. It was just very odd.
Yeah, it's a very odd. I mean, and like I said, it has an interesting idea. It's just the problem with it that I had with it is that, you know, it's also an action film, and they throw in all these big action sequences, which are neat. But like I said, it's like how they shot them. It's like everything shaky, and then the slow motion in some parts is just drawn out. Even at the end, when you get to the big finale,
right.
You know, the big destructive finale, and it's like it just drags, and it's like, okay, look, just make it happen, you know. But it's, I mean, like, I think it's not a bad movie. Like I said, it doesn't teeter on bad, and it doesn't teeter on good. It's like in the middle, and it's
so it's basically a movie of like the haves versus the have nots, almost. Kind
yeah,
of like
yeah, and we've seen that kind of story before, yeah,
right?
Because
I saw a similar story. I would say it's another sci-fi movie. It's with Matt Damon, where it was called Elysium, where
yeah.
all the poor people lived on Earth, and all the rich people lived on
yeah.
like Mars
oh,
or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That one,
or
I
Saturn.
Yeah, that was where yeah they're living on Earth because Earth has become this
like a cesspool almost.
Yeah, cesspool, and then
and
another planet, and they have like yeah, it's
and
like,
they could cure cancer up there, and they
yeah,
could just do
yeah.
anything,
and it's supposed to be like this. I don't want to go down that route of politics, but it's
yeah.
supposed to be this.
Well,
it's supposed to be a metaphor for free health, you know, like socialized health care. And I'm like, oh, for God's sake, you know, just tell a fucking story, please.
Yeah.
And we don't want to go down
yeah,
that road, but still.
Movies can be sometimes heavy-handed.
Yeah,
in
they can be.
But but yeah, I kind of liked it, but again, I felt the same thing. I was like, you know, just tell the damn story.
Yeah,
You don't need to have your personal beliefs.
Right.
Or,
well, I mean, not just that. It's just, it's one of those stories, and you know, because he's trying to get this girl cured.
Right, you have cancer.
And it is kind of a heartbreaking little story. It's just, the more it keeps pouring on the social significance, it's
yeah.
like, well, now I'm starting to care a little less. I don't
yeah.
want to know
yeah,
about
it. Didn't you review that one time before?
I don't think we talked about it.
But
we might have talked about it, but
yeah.
I did not review it.
Okay.
So. But, yeah, Snowpiercer, it's just, again, it has interesting ideas. The other problem with it is that I know when I say 126 minutes, it doesn't sound very long.
Right.
I mean, I recently saw Interstellar, and that movie was like 148.
Yeah, I wanted to see that.
Yeah,
that
and that one's not bad either. I mean, but maybe I'll review that one next time. But it's just... But it's like, you know, it does. You don't have to tell a long, you know, a long movie doesn't make your story better. And that's just the problem
right.
what I've
right.
said.
Sometimes these movies would be better at
yeah.
like a 90-minute running
yeah.
time.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I've seen like one of my favorite, you know, classic directors is Akira Kurosawa, and I've seen Seven Samurai, and that movie's 3 hours long. And I never noticed the running time. That's because the story is so well told, you don't care.
Yeah.
But when you get to Snowpiercer, it's like, well, the story feels very thin, and you're trying to stretch it out.
Yeah.
And it's like,
well,
they could have made it 90 minutes, and it would have been fine.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I know, yeah, some movies have a longer running time. It feels like no time has passed at all. But then
oh, yeah.
you get a really bad 90-minute movie, and you're just
it feels like 2 hours.
it feels like double the running time of Titanic. I mean, or something.
Right.
Or 8 hours worth of The Hobbit.
Well, and The Hobbit's a different story. Or Lord of the Rings.
Well, I mean, anything that's a long movie.
Like Lord of the Rings, you've got the director's cut, the extended cut, and then next is going to be the let's combine all three films into one and give you a 24-hour fiction. It's like, well, we can't do this. But yes, that's Snowpiercer for you.
All right. Well, now we can move on to our main event in the meat and potatoes.
Oh, yes.
Now, normally we run a trailer, as we normally do, but as with the Swedish movie from our first horror episode, Dead Snow, there was no English subtitle or English dubbed trailer, so we're just going to move on to the synopsis.
Yes, yes. Well,
and Chris?
Well, let's set the stage here. Now, the two films we will be talking about is in regards to fandom and how fandom can sometimes become obsession, and then becomes obsession and leads to dangerous areas. And we have two films we're talking about. One is called The Fan from 1982, made in Germany.
Or Der Fan.
Der Fan. Made in Germany, and then we also have another film, which is a classic that we love, Misery from 1990. Both films, in my opinion, excellent examples of how fandom can be taken to an extreme level.
Yes.
Yeah, so with The Fan, which I will be introducing to you, let me set this stage too. The Fan is interesting because if you are fellow listeners remember Severpod, we actually did an episode with Severpod quite some time back involving the German horror film.
Yeah, you can skip that one if you ever find it.
Well, no, if you ever find it. Actually, I encourage that one because in as much as we hated those two films that we reviewed, which was Violence.
And I reviewed four.
Yeah. Well, we got to set the stage for this because I have to because it's just so amusing.
Okay.
And it falls into place somehow. But during our Severpod run, we did Horror from Germany, I believe. Banned in Germany or something.
Yeah,
like
Banned in Germany.
Yeah. And by the way, these two movies that we did review should be banned in Germany. Not because of them being horror films, but because they were completely awful.
They're shite.
Yeah. We had reviewed Andreas Schnass's film Violent Shit and then Olaf Ittenbach's film Burning Moon, which both films were absolutely beyond terrible. If you can find this episode, if it's still out there, please give it a listen because the old Severpod team tore these movies to bits. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this is because we basically had this feeling that, well, if this is what German horror is, we don't want to have a part of it. However, after seeing The Fan,
yes,
I would say I actually wish we had seen this film for that.
Yeah, but see, that wasn't banned.
That wasn't banned.
Didn't fit the criteria.
Well, it wasn't banned, but it was. I know I'm jumping a little far ahead of that. But The Fan is actually an exception to the rule. Here is an example of a pretty decent German horror film. So, with that said, I will be introducing you the plot line here. So, The Fan, made in 1982, during West Germany. That was when the country was split. Directed by Eckhard Schmidt and also written by Eckhard Schmidt. And music by Rheingold. This was back during the early German New Wave rocks band artists that were beginning. Mm-hmm. So, The Fan takes place in then West Germany in the town of Ulm. And focuses on young teenage girl Simone, played by Desiree Nausbuch, who is very beautiful, and her infatuation over popular music performer who is given the distinctive letter name R, who is played by Bodo Steiger, a former band member of Rheingold fame. R has taken Germany by storm with his music, and now you might think that liking a music pop star isn't a problem, but in Simone's case, it is a problem, as she sends letters to R expressing her love for him and constantly pines for his affection. Simone's fan obsession gets in the way of her life. She distances herself from her parents, withdraws any interest in school, and ignores her friends. Clearly, this is a case of Simone not getting the shizit again. yes, our favorite word from the Severpod episode we were talking about. So Simone sends another letter to R and waits a week for him to respond. As she waits, she hears news that R will be performing a special televised music video in Munich. So after receiving no response from him, Simone decides to hitchhike her way to Munich in anticipation of meeting her idol. When R finally arrives at the TV station and signs autographs, Simone is hesitant in meeting him. When R offers to give her an autograph, Simone faints, and she is taken inside the TV studio to recover. Once Simone feels better, R invites her to be a member of the live audience and watch him perform his music video, which I have to say, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it, is one of the strangest music videos have ever seen.
Very bizarre.
Very bizarre. All right, we'll hold that thought. So after the show is aired, R invites Simone to come with him to his private apartment, and they both proceed to have some hot German sex. And then...
Which isn't so hot.
Which isn't so hot, yeah. But it is German sex, yeah. So we'll get to it.
It's very efficient.
Very efficient.
What's going on inside Tim's head right now?
Afterwards, R is about to leave Simone for an engagement, but Simone's infatuation overwhelms her and refuses to let R go, even if that means killing him. Ah, yes, the fan. Before we begin... I had not actually heard about this film until the DVD company, and now DVD turning to Blu-ray company, Mondo Macabro, one of my favorite distributors, announced they were putting this movie out, and I had never heard of it. And they actually released this in two editions. They released a limited red case, limited edition release back in February of 2015, which I do have that case right here with me, and it was limited edition up to 500 copies, but just came with a Blu-ray, which is great. Mm-hmm. And then they just recently released a Blu-ray-DVD combo of the film on March 10th, 2015. So I was able to get this limited edition because I love the company so much. So anyways, hadn't seen this film. Hadn't actually never heard of it. Watched it, and I have to say I was very impressed with it. It was one of those films that I thought, you know, okay, maybe it'll pique some interest and curiosity. But at the end of it, I was very, very impressed with it.
Yeah, well... Again, me too. Didn't know anything about it. Didn't watch a trailer, which, by the way, if you find a trailer on YouTube, which we'll probably be posting in the next few weeks, we're going to ruin it for you anyway, but the trailer gives away the entire film.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and
I mean,
I don't like that at all.
I don't like that either. But, well, even though I don't think there's a trailer out there in English for it.
Yeah.
Either, so
no, it's got English subtitles. So
okay.
It's got German audio. But, no, I was really, really... So shocked at the ending of it, but really enjoyed the whole film. I mean, you could see her slow descent, kind of from pushing away her family and friends, and even a possible boyfriend, because there's a guy that kind of
there's
her
a guy
too.
That's constantly like, well, not constantly, but once in a couple of scenes is like trying to get her attention, and she just does. I think at one point he gives her a mixtape, and she just like sick of it.
Yeah, and she's constantly got her headphones on, and she's just kind of like in her own like our utopia kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's you made an interesting point because you talked to me about this briefly after you saw this, and you said that it's a very slow burn movie, and I have to agree. It's because when I first watched it, stylistically speaking, it's not very. It's not too visual. I mean, it doesn't really have a particular style. I'm not trying to knock the director of this, Eckhart Schmidt.
I think it's very subdued on purpose just because it wants to give you that shock, 10 minutes or 15 minutes after the death of R.
I mean, Eckhart Schmidt, he doesn't create a visual film. I mean, in my opinion, if you look at it through that angle, it is very flatly shot. But at the same time, I think it works best for it.
Right.
The idea that there's not a lot of dialogue in it. In fact, you really don't. And many will think this is a flaw of the movie, but I actually think it kind of works for the movie. Is you don't really get to know anything about her life that much. You just see her parents, who you don't see much of.
Right.
You see the one guy that you think is trying to get her attention.
Right. You see her kind of daydreaming in school and just walking out.
And it just seems like you don't know anything about all the other characters that are supposed to be part of her life, which many will probably think is actually a writing flaw. But I actually think it helps the movie because it creates that distance.
Right, right. And that's exactly what I felt. It's like I felt like I knew the post office master more than I knew the parents.
Yeah,
you know?
Because
she kept
visiting
the post office guy.
Right.
Is there anything for me? And finally he was just like, no, there's nothing for you. Because she'd go to her P.O. box or whatever it is. And R. still hadn't written her. And she just, you know, eventually she stows away in like some guy's car. She's like sleeping in some back, which I found very odd.
There's these weird moments. It's like she, like at one point, she. I mean, I guess you could say what makes the movie work, even though I would think on one level it would be a detraction, is it feels like this movie is shot by a bored observer, but at the same time, it works to capture her character because right. she is a bored observer. She's right. too stuck in her world. And when she gets in this guy's car that, right. that you mentioned, right. she just gets in this stranger's car to sleep in the back seat. Right.
And then she somehow like manages to get a lift to the TV station.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the actually the first driver has like this dog with him and
yeah, oh,
he's
oh,
trying
yeah.
to come on to her.
Oh, yeah, the attempted rape in the parking lot.
Oh,
which
my God.
I like – and she just – yeah, she took care of business there. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, well, she just kicked him and yeah. got out of the car.
Yeah. But, yeah, I walked in with no preconceived notions, so I didn't, you know,
oh,
I didn't
yeah,
know
me
anything.
Too.
And I was blown away by it, and it was very good. Now, it's not a movie that I would probably want to have on repeat. Like, I'd probably watch it maybe every a couple of years. It's not something
yeah,
that, like,
yeah.
oh, I got to watch Derfan. But,
yeah.
It's actually really good. So, I recommend you guys checking it out.
Right,
I think
right.
Chris does, too.
And Desiree Nosbitt plays a very good character in here. I mean, she's very attractive, very good looking.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, this is something I kind of thought about, too. In the realm of movies involving
she's
stalkers.
She's not really a stalker.
Yeah, or people that have obsessions.
Because he invites her in. He's the one that like nurses her back to health. I should say like wakes her up, you know, from
right.
her passing out. He gives her money to get food at the TV station so she can eat a meal.
Yeah,
he's like doesn't feel like he's being stalked. It's like almost like a relationship, like a friendship kind of like.
Yeah, yeah, it kind of leans that way.
Yeah, and I'm like, okay, so she's like her feelings being reciprocated by R. So
yeah.
It's like. Okay, where's it go?
Well, yeah, and before I mention it, I just wanted to say too, like I said, it was what's interesting about these type of films that involve like stalker types or like the fan obsession,
mm-hmm.
is that usually the fans are portrayed as these very ugly characters.
Mm-hmm.
And in this film, it's actually a pretty decent looking girl who you know you'd say to herself, man, she could actually have a bright future ahead of her.
Right.
Instead, she's become this. Obsessed individual who pines for this pop star's affection.
Yeah, and the guy wasn't even that attractive.
I
find guys attractive. Speaking for like settlers
very,
and reachers,
was,
I mean, she's definitely would be the reacher, and he'd be a settler.
Right,
I mean,
right. He's well, the guy who plays our Bodo Steiger. What's interesting about his character that I found an example of. How different this is from the standard norm right. of these types of films is that you'd think that his character would be this uptight, you yeah. know, full of it, music pop
right.
star.
He's very
and he's
laid
actually
back.
He's actually very laid back and very nice and
yeah.
just doesn't have any problems
and,
of anything.
And now we're skipping ahead that now she's at the studio and she's watching them perform and
yeah.
then he says that he wants a break from he tells his bandmates and his manager that he wants a break he's going to go on a, like a vacation or something
right
and he takes what was her name I'm sorry, I forget
Simone
yeah. takes Simone with him to a friend's I guess bungalow or
yeah,
house
yeah well it was I think well I describe it as his private apartment
right.
or something like that.
And so they go there and, you know, they screw,
yeah.
which is a very weird love scene, by the way.
It's a very weird love scene.
And at the time, she was like 16 or 17 years
old. Yeah.
And they actually do full nudity on her, which is, you know, very strange. I know maybe the rating system or adult system there is different.
I did watch the extra features. The whole movie was legal on above
yeah.
board,
right,
so it wasn't
right.
like
no, it wasn't. It wasn't like
yeah.
you know, as they call it, kiddie porn or whatever.
Yeah,
it is.
No,
but,
it wasn't.
But she was like 16 or 17 when she, or 17 or 18 when she filmed the movie.
Yeah,
but it was just very strange to see that, and it was like, it was after they'd done their business. He's like, oh, I'm gonna put on my jacket. I'm gonna go back to my bandmates. Maybe I acted too hastily. I'm gonna go talk to
yeah.
them. And then she flips out over kind of seemingly almost nothing.
Yeah,
you know?
and it's very interesting that she flips out about that because he doesn't even like insinuate that he's gonna leave her.
Right.
He says, "You can stay here. I'm
right.
gonna come back."
Yeah. So I mean, I don't understand the whole thing, but she takes like a big statue and impales it into
oh,
his head.
Oh yeah, and I remember seeing that. I was like, "Whoa, wait, come on!"
Right. And truthfully, that isn't even the most disturbing part. Let's talk about what happens next.
Yeah. Okay.
Holy Christ!
Well, all right, now look, folks. We do spoilers all the time. All right.
And let's face it, we're not giving anything away. If you already, have already seen the trailer, you've already spoiled it for yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if you haven't seen this and you don't want to spoil it for you, you know, please skip ahead. But so basically, after she kills him, well, she's gotta hide the body. So what does she do? She takes an electric carving knife and proceeds to cut him up. And by the way, before I finish about what she does afterwards, it's very interesting how I like how Eckhart Schmidt handles this, because he doesn't quite make it graphic. He doesn't quite overdo, like, blood and guts. He
And truthfully, yeah, he doesn't overdo it with the blood and guts. But when she takes that carving knife, the electric carving knife, I still was cringing, because it just, you know, all you basically, you hear the sound effects of the blade hitting the bone, and you just, and you see, but you don't see a whole lot. It's very conservative when it came to showing that. But why it was still conservative, it was still very effective, I was just grossed out by it.
It was very effective in the story. I remember when she picked up that electric carving knife, I was like, oh, where is this going?
Because
and it didn't, you know.
Well, because, you know, we've seen movies like even the Evil Dead remake where they're just cutting off body limbs. And this didn't even have the same effect on me as this did, because field felt more, I guess, real.
It felt a little close, I guess you can say, a little close to home in the sense of reality. But it is a very effective sequence in that it does sort of follow the odd rule of less is more.
Right.
So then after she cuts him up and puts him in the freezer, she decides to basically cook up the body parts and eat them. And it's such a very, again, how far her character goes to this insane descent into fandom is just truly out there. So then what she does afterwards, she eats the corpse. She takes the bones and then grinds them up and puts them in the bag. And she is very effective in making it look like he just disappears, because she doesn't get caught. Or at least we don't think she gets caught yet.
Well, if there's no body, there's really no crime.
Yeah, yeah. So then she eats,
she ate him.
She ate him, yeah. But then she takes the dust of the bones.
Yeah.
And like she goes outside where the TV station where they met, and she just starts spreading the dust or the ashes around. And then she goes home, and then she's kind of acting like her life is just going to get back on track.
Right.
Like, she says, I'm going to go back to school and everything. And then she reveals in her personal diary that she's going to give birth to his child, and he will be reborn again.
Which was really creepy.
It was really odd. I mean, I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's like she almost had no remorse at all.
No remorse, yeah.
And there's a few scenes where... Okay, so obviously the cutting up the body was freaky, but then you see her. There's like a little montage where she's like actually like cooking the feet and the legs.
I'm
like,
man.
Holy crap! And then you see she's sitting down, like, you know, she's sitting at the dinner table, and she's just making it also, you know, pretty, and she's just slowly eating his body.
I know,
and I'm
so
like,
weird.
Oh my god, where's my garbage can? I just want to vomit.
Yeah,
you know?
And of course it does. And what makes it work is that it's not too overly graphic.
Right,
you get it immediately. And it's still disturbing. And it's still effective. And it's still creepy. And it's like... But the thing about it is that in as much as she has no remorse, at the end of the movie, she still professes his love for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that just shows how far that fandom has gone for her. It's...
Right.
Yeah. We should also mention... We gotta mention this, because it sticks out like... Not a sore thumb, but it just... It's in my head, basically.
I'll spit it out.
Well,
sorry.
It's how, because we've mentioned it briefly. How about that weird music video that R does?
Oh yeah, and I didn't get it, so I'm like thinking maybe it was some sort of like German pop art '80s kind of like weird thing with mannequins.
It probably was,
because I didn't understand it at all. I mean, I was like, I was trying to look for some sort of symbolism, and now getting back to that, I was. To that scene where he's just walking around with a skull cap on his head to make himself bald,
yeah,
look like
a
mannequin.
Yeah, right.
I was watching the director's I wouldn't say commentary, but
the
interview on the deluxe DVD or Blu-ray. He was talking about all these like different subcontexts, and like personally growing up in America and living what we live now and not knowing anything about like the socialism and, you know, communism kind of like fight in between. When he was trying to make some correlations in his film, I was like, I didn't see that at all. Did you?
I kind of saw some of it. He did say that the film was, in a sense, it was his slight statement about National Socialism in regards to Adolf Hitler, because He is portraying this idea that this music rock star, this pop artist, has gotten this legion of fans that just is just worshiping and idling him, worshiping him like he's right. like he's a god in a sense, kind of like how, you know, in a way how the Germans at the time during Nazi Germany were looking.
But then he made some sort of statement like, was it really like Hitler or his R, like because they needed him or because
yes,
they wanted?
Yes, he said like in the case of Hitler, did the Germans seek Hitler? Or did Hitler or seek the Germans? In the sense that's with R. Does the youth seek R or does R seek them?
Right.
And it's very interesting. I can see some of the subtext in that. It's very interesting.
But it's like at the time when I watched it, I'm like, I totally didn't get that. I'm like,
well,
I mean, maybe it's because of the time and frame.
Yeah, yeah.
And
also this was made during a time when, if any of you out there are familiar with your history, this was made at a time when Germany was split between the East and the West. This was a West German production. And East Germany was communist, so there was this, I guess you could say, I mean, the 80s for that time in Germany, I think, was kind of this odd transition period, because also they were having the big, in the case of this film, the music was done by Rheingold. Rheingold was at that time part of that, what was then known as the new German wave of music, also dubbed Krautrock, if you wanted to use another term for it. But
I didn't get the music. I mean, obviously didn't understand, but I didn't get the appeal of it. It just felt very, like, very monotone. If you watch the concerts.
Well, that's what a lot of the German rock at that time or some of
when
the
I, when I hear new wave, I hear different like pop. Like when I hear new wave, I automatically think of, and I'm gonna date myself, but Flock of Seagulls and B-52s.
Well, every country had their own version of new wave of it, and that was kind of the new wave music at that time.
Right.
It's one of those films. Like if you don't understand the history at the time and understand the transitions that were going on, there's elements in there that aren't going to that are just going to go over your head.
Right.
But even if you don't get those elements,
it's
the
still
film
a very
still works.
It's still very enjoyable. It's one of those films that are that we would dub like multi-layered and with subcontext, and it was very good. And I recommend you guys checking it out.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was a very good film too. I mean, I recommend the movie. I won't say great film, but I will say it's good.
Yeah,
I will say it's one of those things where I do wish we reviewed this for Severpod. It would have helped revitalize our interest in 80s or 90s German horror. It would have made up for those other two films that we had to endure.
You keep saying violent shit, but I also watched violent shit 2 and 3.
That was because I think Mark had tricked you.
He sent me a text. It doesn't need to be rehashed, but he sent me a text, and I was like, oh, I thought it as not a joke, and I watched the other two, and never again.
And in a certain way, you know, The Fan, it's not a bloody horror film. I mean, it can be taken.
There's really not a whole lot of blood and guts and spatter. There's no swearing, really.
As far as
other than a couple of shits.
Yeah,
I think
a couple of shizens. Yeah. You can tell we love that word. Yeah. We had a fun time with that.
Yeah.
Again, on that old episode. I wish someone can find that. I don't think it's out there anymore, but if someone can find that episode, or if someone can find a way to get it back and just bring it on there, maybe we can try to find it and do a special best of where we pick out, like, hey, let's do an oldie show where we talked about it. Because I'm not trying to harangue on this, but I just remember when Mark and myself were at your house.
Yeah, we were watching that.
And we watched The Burning Moon. We could not believe what we watched.
Yeah.
And we were just so...
I was kind of drunk and pissed, I think.
Oh yeah, well, when we got to violent shit, we were just like, done.
Yeah.
We could not believe it.
I looked at Mark like, what the fuck did we just watch?
Yeah, and I think Ken Zuckerman was the one that came
and
up.
And Ken wasn't even there.
wasn't there. But then,
that's like an April Fool's joke.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then of course our theme for violent shit was, you know, what was it like? Oh god, what was it? It was like a... We didn't realize that a single generator and a shovel could be used for... I know, yeah.
It's
just... again,
I purposely blocked out some of those...
If you can find that episode, please listen to it, and please send us letters or whatever asking us... I would probably say that was the best Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode we've ever, themed episode we've ever done. You know,
yeah.
I mean, but yeah, so yes, that's The Fan. I recommend it. And
yeah, I recommend it. I think it's time to put The Fan to bed. And
put it to bed.
Well, that brings us to our second film.
Oh, our favorite.
By Misery from 1990. And we're going to, Chris, you want to roll that trailer since we do have
it? Oh, yes, right away.
You almost died. You have a compound fracture of the tibia in both legs, and the fibula in the right leg is fractured too. And as soon as the road's open, I'll take you to a hospital. In the meantime, you've got a lot of recovering to do.
There is nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
My name is Annie Wilkes.
I think one of my clients, Paul Sheldon, might be in some kind of trouble.
You mean Paul Sheldon, the writer? Well, everybody sure likes those Misery books.
They had it at the store, Paul.
They said he checked out last Tuesday. Isn't that a little strange?
I guess it was kind of a miracle you finding me.
In a way, I was following you.
You were following me?
Oh, Paul, I've read everything of yours, but the Misery novels. You must be a good man. You could never have created such a wondrous, loving creature as Misery Chastain.
Very kind.
The presumption must now be that Paul Sheldon is dead.
You dirty bird. How could you? Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Misery's spirit is still alive.
I don't want her, Spit! I want her! And you murdered her!
You don't think he's dead, do you?
And don't even think about anybody coming for you, because I never called them. Nobody knows you're here. And you better hope nothing happens to me. Because if I die, you die. You've been out. Is this what you're looking for? Eventually, you'll come to accept the idea of being here.
Annie, whatever you think I'm not doing, please don't do it. Annie, for God's...
Shh, darling. Trust me.
God's sake!
It's for the best. God, I love you.
Wow. Just wow. Amazing. What do you think, Chris?
Wow. Still holds up. I mean, it's you know, Misery is just one of those films that it's again, even if we talked about The Fan, even if you happen to not see that film, at least see Misery, because that I think is one of the ultimate fan obsession movies. Surprisingly directed by a comedian.
Yes, Rob Reiner. Meathead.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't know who Rob Reiner is, he's done Misery, directed Misery. He's directed When Harry Met Sally, Princess Bride, A Few Good Men.
Yeah, he was involved.
This is Spinal Tap.
Yeah, which I think Christopher Nolan had more to do with that movie than Rob Reiner, if you think about how similar that is, because I believe Christopher Nolan is in that movie, and how similar that film is to Christopher Nolan's later mockumentaries.
Oh,
it's very similar in style. So.
But and also another favorite of mine, Stand By Me, which is another Stephen King novel.
Yeah.
He directed that.
Two Stephen King.
In fact, just before we get into it, Stephen King was very reluctant in signing off the Misery rights to do a movie unless Rob Reiner directed, because he was so happy with what he did with Stand By Me. So Misery might not have gotten made if it wasn't for Rob Reiner.
Mm, yeah, wow.
So. All right, so on to the synopsis of Misery, made in 1990, directed by Rob Reiner, based off the novel by Stephen King, with a screenplay written by William Goldman, starring James Caan, Kathy Bates, Richard Farnsworth, Francis Sternhagen, and the legendary Lauren Bacall, which I was very surprised to see it.
I forgot she was in this, actually, until I saw it again recently, and I'm like, oh, wow.
So now, novelist Paul Sheldon, James Caan, is on his way from his cabin getaway in Colorado and is traveling to New York to hand in his latest novel that he just finished to his publisher, Marcy Siddell, Lauren Bacall, when a freak snowstorm sends his car sliding off the side of a cliff. He is then rescued by Annie Wilkes, Kathy Bates, and she takes him back to her home, a farmhouse, which is in a small town out in the middle of nowhere, Colorado. Annie is, at first, seems like a very caring and loving person, saving Paul's life and feeding him and taking care of his injuries. And as the story unfolds, we come to realize that Annie is just a little bit cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. You know, a few sandwiches short of a picnic basket, or the elevator doesn't quite reach the top floor. You get my meaning. Anyway, the audience comes to find out that Annie is Paul's number one fan, and she is extremely upset that Paul has killed off her favorite character in a popular book series called Misery. Now, Annie wants him to rewrite the book. All the while, Marcia Sydell reaches out to the local law enforcement of this small town, asking for help in the missing persons case of Paul Sheldon. The sheriff is played by wonderfully by Paul by Richard Farnsworth, is a small-town sheriff with his deputy wife, played by Frances Steenhagen. These two actually steal the scene in every moment there on the film. They are the comic relief of the story, but their characters are never come off cornball or silly. So with that, let's chat about King's Misery.
Well, you know, I just love this is again what makes Misery work is that it's basically a two character story,
right?
With the exception of the side characters, because you know we only see Lauren Bacall, I think, in like
four scenes.
I think maybe two. I'm trying to remember, like the first or maybe three.
Yeah, because there was a flashback scene.
Yeah. Well, there was a first scene, the flashback scene, and then eventually the film's ending.
Yeah.
But it works best as being this two-character story because this is basically a story about a man who is famous for writing these stories called involving a character named Misery, mm-hmm. you know. And he's just getting tired of writing these stories because he wants to start breaking into something else.
Right, yeah. And that's understandable long series.
And then he finds himself in this situation after getting into an accident with someone who happens to be a big fan of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And then proceeds to get upset at him when he when she reads the manuscript that she pulls out of his car.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, this is just filth.
And
I love the way Kathy Bates' character doesn't swear at all. She uses all these other kind of like kiddie euphemisms.
But then there's that scene where she talks about the guy. It's like, who is the Dago that painted the Sistine Chapel? Oh, Michelangelo. Yes, that's the guy.
She's a very odd bird.
And
Kathy Bates just plays it to the hilt. I mean, she is excellent in this role.
And again, this kind of goes back to what I said with the fan earlier. I said, you know, I'm not saying this to insult Kathy Bates, but, you know, she's obviously not a, quote, attractive person, unquote, in this film. And she's playing this kind of, I guess you could say, frumpy person.
Right,
And it kind of goes back to that same thing where I said that some of these types of stalker or fan-obsessed movies involve characters of that type who are very alone and distant and tend to not be very, quote, attractive, unquote. Right.
And truthfully, I think at that time, she wasn't attractive in the traditional sense.
Oh, yes.
But you take away the frumpy clothes and she's not like
she's very matronly in this film. So I guess that's playing a matronly creature in this.
She just plays it to the hilt. She's just awesome. She makes you kind of scared of her. And, like, she's very eerie at the beginning. Just kind of like, oh, she's so sweet and then kind. And then all of a sudden you realize that she's drugging him and she makes him burn his manuscript. Remember, she brings on the grill and the charcoal light or the lighter.
Right, right.
And then she like flips out because the pages are flying up in the air and she's just trying to get it put out. It was just kind of a bizarre scene. And he's like looking at her like, you're fucking nuts, lady.
I love how James Caan's constant reactions and just his uncertainties come up too. And he's just like, because basically his legs are injured. He can't do anything.
Yeah, he's got two broken legs and a broken arm at one point.
And eventually he'll get a broken foot after. But we'll get to that soon.
Oh, yeah.
But he's stuck in this situation. And then when she tells him that she wants him to write a new book on misery.
Yeah. James Caan character did Paul Sheldon was he killed off Misery.
Right.
And she didn't like that. So he wanted her to rewrite a new book or rewrite the book to bring her back to life or to do something.
And I love the scene. And because I had seen Misery. Oh, God. When did I see? I saw it a long time ago because I think someone had given a copy of the to my mom and dad at the time. Mm-hmm. I think this was like middle 90s. And the scene I remember from that sticks with me to this day is when he gets the typewriter and he gets the pages and he says, well, I need you to
get
these.
Oh, yes.
Pages.
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah.
Like,
he's like, well,
smudge.
Yeah, he's like, well, it smudges, you see, and it does that. And he has a look in his face like, you know,
I'd like to write your book, but
yeah,
I need the right paper.
I need the right paper. And she gets all pissed about it. And then she like takes – I'm forgetting now. See, I remember
she takes
so
she takes the ream of paper, the brick of paper.
Yeah.
And she just slams it on his like legs. And
I know.
She's
oh.
like, fine, I'm going to go get your cock-a-doodie paper.
And then she
gets into her car and she takes off to the
now
it should be noted that she as I said she lives on a small they live in a small farm or a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere
and
it's snowing so the rescue search efforts have been kind of like put on hold until it can
get because they can't find the car because it was covered up in the snow
right
so
and then they there's eventually you know. He's missing till pronounced dead because they can't find him anywhere, and they'll probably find him when it thaws in the spring.
Yeah, and it's but I just love that bit because he's just smudges, it just you know.
Yeah.
And I remember, and it's funny too. This is James Caan that's always playing upset people.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've seen him
in
Godfather,
he's the most calm person.
Yeah,
it's like you're stuck in this like horrible situation. This woman's got you like pretty much like. Sitting in the, you can't move anywhere. You're locked in, and she's got every door in the house locked.
Right.
He can't get anywhere.
I mean, if you've seen him in Godfather, where he gets all pissy all the time, and he finally gets shot at the toll booth, you understand what we're talking about. Or
spoilers, jeez.
Whatever. I'm sure hopefully everybody's seen the Godfather. Or at the very worst, you've seen Santa's Sleigh, where he has that silly cameo sequence,
with Fran Drescher,
which we talked about on the Severpod episode. If you can find that one too, I think you'll love it.
Yes, that's our Christmas episode.
Yeah. Where he's just completely angry all the time, and then finally gets killed by an evil
Bill Goldberg.
killed by an evil Santa Claus played by Bill Goldberg. I mean, this is James Caan who's always angry. You know, I mean, but here he's very calm, but then he has to be because he's like, my legs are broken.
Yeah.
I got a crazy woman here. I'm not exactly going to be able to good position to be yet mad at her.
That and if you remember, she brought him the used typewriter, and there's the end didn't work.
Yeah, well, actually, if you watch and there's a montage scene where you see him type. There's a couple of other words too that don't work as well, so it's very.
And so she's so they also show Annie Wilkes like filling in all the ends on the page.
Yeah.
And it was crazy.
Now I love that bit though too, where when he is able to finally get out and like move around the room.
Yeah,
because he finds those pills that he can probably use to knock her out.
Right, and he has to be very sneaky about it, and he has to save up all the pills to grind them into powder.
Right, but also. He knocks over that little penguin thing that he puts back, facing the wrong way.
Yeah, in your living room or front room of the house.
Now, by today's standards, we can tell where that's going. But back then, I remember, again, watching this when I was a little younger, like, that's not an important plot point. And it ends up being an important plot point.
Right.
But before we get to that, I like the part where they have the dinner.
Oh, yes. The celebration dinner for misery.
Yeah, yeah. And he tries to take the grounded powder from the pills and puts it in their wine glass.
Yeah, he says he gets her back out in the kitchen to bring what, an extra glass or some wine or – no, not a wine. It was something.
It was some item.
Yeah, some item. And then you see him, like, carefully – put the powder into her wine and they mix it around because they're celebrating. She comes back. And what happens?
She comes back, and then they're about to do the toast, and she accidentally knocks it over. And it's funny, too, because I always get this suspicion watching that scene, wondering maybe did she know and she just knocked it over intentionally or if it was an accident. There's something odd about the scene. Because
I think it was just coincidence.
Coincidence,
but the look on James Caan's face when that happens and he's like...
Yeah, all that work for nothing.
For fuck's sakes.
I just love it. He looks like all that work for nothing.
Yeah, it's like he threw your pants and like whatever.
Yeah, like
at this point,
God damn it. now, so what's interesting about this movie, and I actually mentioned it to you, is he's basically trapped in this situation. He has to write this book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a montage sequence that comes up where we see him typing away, and eventually starts typing more. And basically, his creative mind is at work and everything.
Right.
And he, as much as for someone who's trapped in this horrible scenario, he starts to finally look like he's kind of getting used to it, in a sense. And I found that very odd, considering how much he wants to leave. But then again, as you mentioned, considering that he's
a writer,
and maybe this is
He's got no, but he's got a writer. He's got no place to go.
Yeah,
he's in the zone. He's like, well, maybe I can do. His creative juices just are flowing.
Oh yeah, so he's
like,
going to go for
what the hell is he going to do?
But then there's a scene that comes up where when she gives him the medicine, she just kind of throws it there and is all depressed, and he just looks at her, and you'd think for a guy who like knows this person is crazy and doesn't want to give a damn whether or not this person's depressed or not,
right?
Why would he just say, oh, well, what's wrong, you know? I mean, because there's something about that that was just – I'm not saying bad things, but I'm not crapping on it. But just saying there's just – the way how it's directed, it just feels like there's this odd sense going on with it.
And while this is all going on, where he's they're writing the book and they're going back and forth, we see the detective start slowly putting the pieces together.
Yeah.
Going to the old general store and
and
the town and just doing some investigative – old-school investigative work
right,
at the library.
Now, that – I like how he buys the books for Misery and
starts reading them. Yeah.
But the part of the movie that kind of I don't want to say is it's not a bad part. It doesn't quite work for it in a sense is that he says, maybe I'll find something in these books that will help me lead the way to where he's at or where he could be at if he's alive or dead. And then eventually he starts taking an interesting curiosity towards the Kathy Bates character.
Right.
And then, because there was this, because basically there's a background on Kathy Bates' character where she was involved with some.
Yeah, she was a nurse. She's a head nurse.
She was a head nurse, and there was some bizarre malpractice issues. And he it's like the guy is like writing down lines from various Misery books, certain lines, certain dialogue passages. And then he goes to the town library to look up, not the library, the. Well, maybe it was a town library.
Yeah, he was at the library.
Looking up like the old newspaper stories, and he finds one of the newspaper clippings where Kathy Bates has a line
from the book,
and he makes that connection.
Yes, that's what I kind of thought. That was kind of cool, but also far fetched.
It is a cool idea. I will admit it's a cool idea, but it is also very far fetched because yes, she's a fan of his stuff. Maybe she memorizes certain dialogue.
Right.
From it,
it's like anybody quoting any kind of movie or television show that we've seen.
That plays a part of your life. But at the same time, I was like, but then the fact that this cop, this sheriff, has that line written on a post-it note that he looks over and goes, aha, is like, well, okay, that's a little bit of a stretch for this movie. But it is a cool idea.
And I'll tell you, I love the scenes with him and his wife, the deputy, because it's just feels so organic. And it's like they're quipping back and forth. He's like, well, you're my deputy, so we can't do that. She goes, well, I'd rather go to bed with the sheriff.
And I like how she's like, well, can't we just make out in this truck? Is it not while we're working, you know?
Yeah.
Or she starts talking back to him. He goes, and he just says very blandly, he's like, that's the spice of life that we need in our sex life.
And then, right before he finds the poster, he goes, you know that note I had, or you know that.
Yes.
Yeah, give it to me. She goes, oh well, then if you, it's no of consequence. And she goes, well, I'm glad. I hope you enjoy it then, or something. She says some kind of bizarre thing.
Yeah, he's like, see, that's the spice of life that we need in our sex life. I gotta say, I do feel bad for Farnsworth's character.
I'm going to backtrack just a quick bit. Because as they're searching for Paul Sheldon before they give up on him, there's a helicopter scene where he's in the helicopter. And guess who's sitting next to him flying the helicopter?
Oh.
That's Rob Reiner.
Yeah, Rob Reiner. Okay, yeah. God, I'm surprised he didn't say, hey, Meathead, can you get this plane to go down?
Can we get
this helicopter? Maybe we could have gotten Archie Bunker.
Carol O'Connor.
Carol O'Connor is sitting there.
But
I'll bet you he gets that all the time. I'll bet you he has someone come up to him and call him Meathead all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And he probably gets pissed about it. I directed Spinal Tap, for God's sake. Well,
Princess Bride.
I'd probably be like, well, you know, the Spinal Tap plays a lot more like Christopher Nolan, to tell you the truth. But anyways.
So he goes out to the house just to check out what's going on. Because obviously I think he put two and two together because, one, she's also – they living in Colorado, where the car went off, you know, the cliff or the side of the cliff, and many things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And there's also a scene where he goes into the local bookstore and he's talking to the cashier, the owner, and he's like, do you sell a lot of these books? And he goes, oh, yeah. And that Annie Wilkes comes in here and has me put aside a copy every time a new book comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of, I guess, more justification for him to investigate further. And also in that scene, you also see in the background the video of When Harry Met Sally for rental or purchase. I just thought that was kind of funny. But anyway, getting back to the story, he goes out to Annie Wilkes' farm, and you know, he goes in there and he starts talking to her, and everything is fine. And you see him like leave, which is awesome because you thought for sure that she's gonna like poison his lemonade or his cocoa, and he leaves. But then he goes back because he hears Paul Sheldon in the or somebody making noise in the basement.
Yeah,
because
she puts him in the basement hide him, and then eventually because she like injected him with something.
Yeah,
some sedative,
like a
whatever.
Sedative. Yeah,
and then
pushes him down the stairs.
Yeah, pushes him down the stairs, and then eventually he comes to and yells, and then Farnsworth comes in.
He knocks over the grill.
Yeah, knocks over the grill
that he burned his manuscript in, and he's like, "What the hell's going on? Help me, help me!" And then you see Annie Wilkes appear and a shotgun blast and. Poor sheriff.
Oh God!
Gets it.
I know.
Right in the back.
Yeah. And well, he got it right in the back, and unfortunately, James Caan character got it in the foot earlier on.
You know,
we gotta have to mention that.
Oh yeah, hobbling.
The hobbling. God! That's again.
Remember how I think these two films play well with one another because less is more.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see the sledgehammer, and you see. You don't see the actual connection, I think, of the foot. You see it, and you see the first one, and you hear the crunch, and you see the foot like bent backwards, but then you don't see the second one. So again, that's like less is more kind of mm-hmm. thing. Not very graphic, but definitely very effective.
Yeah.
Ugh.
It's a disturbing scene. I mean, I saw it again too. I was just like, there's something about it where you. It's going to happen. The anticipation of it happens. You just wish it doesn't.
Yeah.
And then you see the one shot where she does hit him in the foot, and you do see it very briefly, and it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah,
and
like,
it's just disturbing.
Fuck. But when she brings up the hammer, and she brings up the sledgehammer, and she's like, you know, back in, you know, I forget what country it is, they don't want to kill the workers, but they want to make sure they can't get away.
Right.
So they cut off their feet.
Yeah.
Or
instead of
like
cutting off their feet, she just decides to make him hobble.
Yeah, she just breaks his leg
or
ankle, and I'm like,
so,
oh, dear God.
Oh, yeah. So then we get to the big finale because, you know, basically
she's
now,
shot the cop or the sheriff.
Yeah.
And the law is coming.
Right. Well, maybe we'll be coming.
Well, he said he's going out to the Wilkes farm. You know, there's obviously going to be more people going to be looking for
the
cop.
Right. So eventually she says the best way out is, you know, to
basically a double suicide.
Double suicide. But, of course, Khan's character, because he's able to stoke away a that little can of kerosene is able to convince her we should do it together in a more romantic way and everything.
Right.
So they set the whole thing up. And he says, and I got to finish Misery, too.
Yeah.
It's the last book.
Buying a little more time.
Yeah, buying a little more time. So he does. And, you know, that's what I love about this. We don't find out. We find out what the story of Misery, the final one that Paul Sheldon wrote before the accident is.
Right.
When Kathy Bates reads the manuscript.
Right.
But we don't find out, and that's what was so interesting. We don't find out the story about this new rewrite he's doing for
her.
We get little pieces and stuff, but not a lot of it. So I find it interesting when he burns the, because eventually
he
burns the manuscript and the last few pages.
Right.
It's
so
like we never find out, and
we
never find out too. She never finds out. The audience never finds out. And I love it because that's what. She just goes batshit crazy and just starts.
They start pummeling. She takes out the revolver and she shoots him in like the arm. And they just battle back and forth. I mean, it is down
and
dirty.
She starts,
it's like,
and she replaces her nice swearing with something extreme, like "you goddamn fucking cocksucker."
Yeah, yeah. It's like all that like cock duty and grade school like you know talk is just out the window, and she just becomes like this freaking sailor on leave, and she's just letting it fly, and she's.
He lets it fly too with that metal. I think it was the
he bashed in her head with a typewriter.
Bashes in her head with a typewriter, but then he ends. They do the classic, you know.
Yeah, fight for the gun kind of thing.
Yeah, well, no, they do that, and then he bashes her head, and then he thinks she's dead, and then when he's crawling away, she grabs him again.
Well,
it's the shock.
Well,
and,
it's always that second shock value.
But then he grabs some metallic. It's like I thought it was an iron type thing or whatever, and just repeatedly whacks her in the face.
Yeah, you think that put her down. And then she comes back, and it's like, I guess it's very fitting that, you know, she trips and then smacks her head on the typewriter.
Yes.
That he already had picked up and hit her with. So it's basically like she's falling on the sword, you know? I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah, everything Paul Sheldon's character has gone through, it comes to this. And then, of course, there's the ending where it's like the...
See Lauren Bacall.
Lauren Bacall, and they're talking at the dinner.
At the thing, toasting his book and his, like, I guess, interviews that are coming up.
And it's interesting because he does admit, you know, because she tries to say to him, well, why don't you write a book about your experiences being held captive?
Right.
And he says, what, so we can make some extra money on the side for this? No. And then he admits, though, that, you know, but having being held captive like that, it kind of... kind of helped me a little bit.
She, in her own weird way, helped him.
And then when he has that brief bit where he thinks he sees her.
Right,
at
the restaurant where she's, like, bringing, like, the trait full desserts.
Yeah, and then it's really some other woman. Yeah. She says, I'm your number one fan. He's like, oh, marvelous. which I actually read a review of that in a book, like one of these film horror books where they said they didn't like that ending because it felt like a tease or something like that. I didn't have a problem with that ending. I thought it sticks in his mind how much that has affected him.
He sees her everywhere, even though she's dead and gone, and he was held captive by her.
And it's the whole thing about fandom, you know, and the obsession. And in this case, as opposed to the fan, where it's about the fan's perspective, it's about the writer held captive, his perspective.
Right.
Says basically, no matter where he goes, if he's going to end up having someone tell him, I'm your number one fan, that's just going to all come back to haunt him.
It's like a flashback or something.
Or in this case, reminding you that you've been held captive. Like you've been in war, and if you were in a POW camp,
flashbacks.
And that's how it ends, and I think it's
a perfect ending. You know, she's gone. He moved on with his life. Thankfully, he didn't end up like R.
being eaten.
Now, I've actually got some fun facts on the notes on Misery. After refusing to speak about his motivations for writing Misery for 2 decades, Stephen King finally came out and stated that it is indeed about his battle with substance abuse. Kathy Bates' character's reputation of his dependency on drugs. And that went into his body, making him feel more alone, separated from everything.
Oh, wow.
While hobbling his attempts.
It's very interesting how that fits into it.
And he didn't want to come out when the movie came out to take away from the story.
Yeah.
And then basically also Stephen King was reluctant to sell the rights to Misery because he was skeptical that Hollywood studios would make a faithful version of his book book into a movie. However, King was very impressed with the adaptation of his other book, Stand By Me, and he agreed to sell it. Under the provision that Reiner would produce and direct the film.
Yeah, and Rob Reiner directed that, so that was...
But I also found out there were some really interesting people that were up for the role of Annie Wilkes and that wanted it. Mary Tyler Moore actually wanted to be Annie Wilkes. Could you see Mary Tyler Moore as Annie Wilkes? I couldn't.
But then, you know what? I can't see her as that character per se, but then she did that movie Ordinary People where she was
automatically think of her and Ed Asner battling it out. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I know. But then again with Ordinary People, you know, she's the domineering mother and everything in that. So I can kind of see it, but I'm a little glad it didn't go with that direction.
And you know, and also Jessica Lange was also interested in the role.
What? Wait, what?
Yeah, Jessica Lange.
Now that would have been a miscast.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying
she's not a bad actress, but
I'm just saying people wanted
it.
You know, and according to the director Rob Reiner, Annie Wilkes' killing spree was loosely based on that of Gina Jones, a nurse who was believed to have killed as many 50 children over a 2-year period at a hospital. And it was crazy, crazy, crazy. Anyway, but that's all I got right now.
Yeah,
the
Jessica Lange. I cannot imagine someone saying that.
Oh yeah,
it sounds so odd.
Oh, now I remember the lady's name, Angelica Houston. She was up for the role, but she had just gotten the movie The Gifters.
Yeah,
so she couldn't do it.
I can kind of see her a little.
Yeah, but I think she would be very tall for the role.
Yeah, domineering over James Caan, that's for sure.
Well,
God damn.
Could you see Angelica Houston swinging a sledgehammer? It would have to be something more petite.
Yeah, I'm. I have a strange feeling that Kathy Bates had to have been like the last person on the list. And then they're like, well, but here we go.
And
but it works.
She knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, yeah. And it's always the there's always a story how they say it's always the last casting decision that ends up somehow being the best one.
Right.
It's amazing.
And you also, did you know that there's a scene, a quick reference to The Shining in the movie. It says, you know that guy who went mad in a hotel nearby?
Yeah,
I saw it. I was like,
okay.
Holy crap. How many kind of like silly, like off the wall, like little nuggets are we going to get?
I'm surprised Stephen King didn't throw a line in there saying, yeah, it was made into a movie that I didn't like. I mean, I'm not saying but Stephen King's not a big fan of the Kubrick adaptation of The Shining, but, you know, but in my opinion, movie's good.
Now, did you say you read the book, or you said you didn't read the
book? I didn't read the book,
okay,
no.
Because in the original novel for Misery, Annie planned to kill Paul by feeding him to Misery, her pig, if you remember that. And then taking his skin.
That pig, yes.
And then taking the skin to bind the book he wrote. So that's sort of what would probably maybe if it happened if more of like with the fan.
Oh my god!
But I'm really glad it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, it's again an interesting aspect of how you take a book and you turn it into a movie and the things that you want to keep and you don't want to keep, and that's not going back to. But I mentioned with The Shining, that's the thing that irritated Stephen King a lot, was not basically making everything from the book, but.
Right.
You know,
well, then, then after his lame attempt at
his lame TV abortion attempt,
yeah, he didn't understand what Kubrick went through. I think he kind of forgave him a little bit.
Well, maybe. I mean, again, it's that thing where, you know, when you do an adaptation from book to movie, you do have to make those liberties. You have to take the best material that would translate well for the screen.
Right.
You can't do the entire book, because if you do the entire book, then what's the point of the book? You know,
yeah.
It's. It means nothing, so it's...
Yeah, and let's face it, Steven Weber, as much as I like him, he's no Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, yeah, no Jack Nicholson, yes, that's true. I mean, can you imagine if King didn't like this movie and did his own TV version Oh, Lord, it would just be another problem.
I heard that, actually, they wanted to do a Broadway musical of Misery.
Oh, come
and they,
on.
And they wanted Julia Roberts to do it. But Stephen King nixed the idea, saying Julia Roberts was a pixie, too much of a pixie, and they said no.
Oh, I would have said no. Come on, I would be like, look, you can't always go back, and you can't always ruin a good thing. The movie's good enough.
Yeah. But I saw that, like, Julia Roberts really on a Broadway show?
Don't forget, didn't they do it? Wasn't there an Evil Dead musical?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I wanted to see that. It was actually in Chicago playing for limited release.
I'm sure it's fun in its own way. But
just because I wanted to see how they'd handle it.
Yeah, I said this. Sometimes you just can't go back.
Yeah.
You just can't go back.
Yeah, so.
We already know from the remake, but that's a different story. We talked about that before.
Oh, you're talking about Evil Dead remake?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were talking. There's a remake of Misery.
No.
Okay.
The Evil Dead remake, which, by the way, if you can find that separate pod episode, please do.
But you mean you can't go back home or go back to the cabin again?
Yeah, because that cabin ain't there anymore. Not in Tennessee. I think the cabin from Evil Dead 2 is kind of there in. I think it's in North Carolina, but yeah, sometimes you just can't go back.
Yeah,
if you do go back to the one in Tennessee, it's just the fireplace that remains.
Yeah.
It's true. That's all that remains. It's just the fireplace.
Wow. Maybe a little plaque that says.
Well, that would be funny if there was one, but I doubt it. But but anyways, we've gone off the rail so much.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's all right. It's our show. We can do what we want.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we got to steer this boat back on track.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, once you hit them waves and them rocks, you're like, so yes, Misery. Yes, it still holds up.
Yes.
I mean, I like the movie still.
So, final rating.
Oh, well, yes, recommended, of course.
Recommended here, too. Yeah, 4 stars,
I mean,
A.
Yeah, yeah, everything.
You can't really go wrong.
4 stars, 20 stars.
I'm your number one fan.
Yeah. Going to go kidnap James Caan and say, now reenact that scene from The Godfather.
We didn't like that ending.
Yeah, yeah.
But, with that, I think it's time to put Misery to bed.
Yeah, much like the character that Caan was trying to put to bed.
Yeah. Put it back in a wheelchair and push it down the stairs.
Yeah. But yes, we enjoyed these movies very much. And hopefully, you out there who are listening will check these out.
Yeah.
Hopefully you have seen Misery.
Misery for sure.
Yeah, but
the fan probably not.
Yeah, but the fan, yes, check that out too. Hopefully you'll enjoy it.
Yes. Well, that's the end of our show, kids. But don't worry, we'll be back in May with a brand new episode simply called That Religious Horror Episode. Chris, would you like to give the listeners a sneak peek into what they can expect?
Oh, from that episode?
Yes.
Yes. Well, from that episode, you can expect us to talk about two religious-themed horror movies, or horror, in this case, God Told Me To, from 1976 by cult movie director Larry Cohen. And then the Bill Paxton-directed Frailty from 2001. Both excellent examples of what we will be talking about for that episode.
Awesome, so. Awesome. I look forward to reviewing both of those. Now, if you would like to send us an email, you can do so in two different ways. One, email us at thathorrorshowpodcast@gmail.com. Or two, send us a message through our official Facebook page at facebook.com/thathorrorshowpodcast. All of our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and we just got PlayerFM.com. You can also find our reviews on Tumblr at thathorrorshowpodcast.tumblr.com. Now, I just posted a new micro review of Devil's Due from 2014, so you can go there and check it out. Thanks, good night, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was going to say son of a bitch, didn't you?